Hello, and welcome to the 8th episode of Pop Art. I am your hive of scum and villainy host, Howard Foster.
Oh my gosh.
The concept of Pop Art is for my guests to choose a movie from popular culture, and I will in turn choose a film from the art classic side of cinema with some sort of connection to it. Today, my guest, Paul Zeidman, a screenwriter, blogger, and script consultant, is my guest. And he has chosen George Lucas's epic, game-changing space opera, Star Wars. I have chosen the great Akira Kurosawa's epic samurai film, The Hidden Fortress. So to begin, Paul, why don't you tell us something about yourself?
All right, Howard. Well, first, thanks for inviting me on. Looking forward to this kind of discussion. A little bit about me. As you said, I'm a screenwriter. Had several scripts to my name, a couple of minor shorts produced, still working on the big picture, so to speak. But in the meantime, just, you know, really enjoying the writing and the endless rewriting, or so it seems. Because of the shelter in place that has been going on for about 2 months now, I've been able to get a lot of my own writing done and been very fortunate to read and offer some notes and feedback on some friend scripts. I'm very fortunate to know a lot of very talented writers. There's some great material out there. And hopefully, once things get back up and running, a lot of these writers will get the break they deserve.
From your lips to God's ears, as they say. To begin, I will give some information on Star Wars. It was released in 1977. The director and writer is George Lucas. And it stars, if anybody out there doesn't already know, Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, Peter Cushing, Alec Guinness, James Earl Jones, Anthony Daniels, Kenny Baker, Peter Mayhew, and David Prowse, with music by John Williams. The basic premise is that long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, in a world where there is a civil war underway, a young rebel sympathizer, a space smuggler, two bickering androids, and a Wookiee transport a princess to safety where they can join forces with the rebels to take out the Empire's new weapon, a Death Star satellite, while evading the evil general Darth Vader. To begin, why did you choose this film?
I've been a movie fan all my life, and Star Wars has had such an impact on me, both as a moviegoer and as a writer. In fact, even before you contacted me about appearing today, you know, I haven't watched the original Star Wars in some time, so I just thought, yep, I will watch it. It is such a tight script and still holds up, except for the 70s era haircuts from Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford. It's a world unto itself. It's very timeless. And, you know, it follows Joseph Campbell's The Hero of a Thousand Faces, about the mythology of the hero's journey. And having studied screenwriting, you can really see everything that for those rules and guidelines is on the screen in terms of the journey and transformation of Luke Skywalker. It came out for me at the exact right time. I was second grade. It's just this amazing science fiction extravaganza. I would say, like, of all the movies I've ever watched in my life, this is among the five I've seen the most.
Oh, well, that's certainly already a recommendation.
So it was 1977, so I was like 7, 8 years old. And what's really funny is that this will always stick with me because my father took myself and one of my older brothers to see it, and we got there late. So we walked in, the movie had already started. So for people familiar with the movie, when we walked in, what was on screen was R2-D2 just before he's attacked by the Jawas. And that's like 15, maybe 20 minutes into the movie. So we sat down, I watched the movie, I was totally enthralled. My dad offered that we could stay and watch to where we came in. And of course, when that scene came in, he's like, okay, let's go. I was like, what? We have to go? So we can't stay and watch it again?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you came in late because I was, just a little older than you when I saw it. I was out of college and had moved to Chicago. I was in my early 20s when I saw it. I saw it, I believe, the first week it came out, and I had heard so much about it. Everybody was talking about it. So I know that George Lucas did this on purpose. When I sit down and it starts, and you see this little spaceship puttering across the screen, I went, oh my God, what a rip. I had been told all about this incredible new special effects, and I just see this little nothing of a spaceship crossing the screen, and then all of a sudden, boom, there's this huge, gigantic battleship that follows it. And I went, oh, okay. I get it now. I get what everybody is talking about. And I think everybody, the audience, sort of felt that way too, because I think they sort of laughed because they were going, what is this? And then suddenly, wham. It was a very exciting story. I was really very, very entertained by it. Why do you think it was so popular? What do you think it sort of struck in the general public?
think there are several reasons for that. One was that the Vietnam War had ended recently before this. The country was kind of in a malaise, so it really needed some kind of pick-me-up to get the national morale back up. And one of Lucas's influences on this were the old Flash Gordon serials from the 30s. That's real evident in the way it's presented, you know, with the words going up, the text on screen at the very beginning, and the different wipes that he has, and just the whole mood of the story. No one had ever done anything like this before. You even said it started, you know, there's this little spaceship, and all of a sudden, for like the next 15 seconds, the Star Destroyer is coming after, and it seems like it's never going to end. You're just thrust into the story. So I think the whole uniqueness of it, the sense of excitement and fun, there's some good one-liners. And it just really captured the imagination of America. It's, 43 years later, and we're still talking about this movie. You know, apart from a handful of films from the 70s, can you really say that about any other movie?
No, I think that's true. It really has. It stood the test of time from that perspective that people still watch today. What are some of your favorite parts of the movie?
That's a really good question, because the more I've watched it, and also because I've learned screenwriting since then, I think what really sticks out to me now is the way that the characters develop, but also that from a writing perspective, the scenes are so tight, the dialogue is so spot on without being too expository or too on the nose, that it gets the point across so fast and it just moves on to the next scene. But in terms of, you know, content of the story, I think a lot of people relate to the beginning when we meet Luke Skywalker and kind of establishing what his life is like and what he wants. And that scene where he goes out and the John Williams score gets very uplifting and emotional, and he's watching the twin sunsets. You know, that's really good. The Mos Eisley Cantina, that was something different that hadn't been seen. Even though it doesn't really take up as much time as you would think in the whole movie, the attack on the Death Star, I think it's only like the last 15, 17 minutes of the movie. And even that, they keep cutting back and forth to all the different parts of the story. I think it's really the editing that helps the story move so quickly, because here's a shot, here's what you need to see, and there's no fat to it. He just gets to the point right away, then moves on to the next one and gets to that point just as fast. Just keep moving and moving and moving.
Yes, those are all great moments. I mean, I think the strongest aspect of the film is the plot. The plot is very well constructed, very entertaining. The plot does really hold your interest. It's very clever. Next to that for me are certain actors, the androids, Alec Guinness, James Earl Jones, Peter Cushing. I don't think a lot of people today realize how original and innovative, both good and bad, the movie was. When the people making films at that time were taking B-movie genres from the 40s and 50s, they were taking genres that were not the A-list, and these were horror films, for sci-fi. These were even film noir crime dramas, which sometimes got A-listing. And they purposely wanted to make these. These kind of movies in the 40s and 50s, the A-list directors would never touch. But now George Lucas wanted to do this movie because of the Flash Gordon. And Steven Spielberg does E.T. and Close Encounters. And Roman Polanski does Rosemary Baby. You have The Godfather and The French Connection. It was a huge, big change in the way movies were being made. Lucas did have a hard time selling this.
Yeah, it's a great story, is that because he was able to make this because of his success making American Graffiti. That was a much bigger success than anyone had anticipated. So then they came to him and said, well, what do you want to make next? He said, well, I actually want to make this science fiction movie. And up until then, science fiction was really considered a second or even a third rate genre. The biggest successes had been like 2001 and Planet of the Apes. So it wasn't really taken seriously by the studios. He kept getting rejection after rejection. And I think it was, I want to say, Richard Zanuck at 20th Century Fox. His attitude was like, yeah, go ahead, whatever. It sounds interesting. And I think Lucas even had to adjust his salary, and because he wanted to do it all his way, and which included he did not want to put credits at the beginning. And they said, well, you can't do that. So he resigned from the Directors Guild. So that's why first thing you see, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and then the music kicks in. Lucas didn't want to adhere to how studio wanted to do it. Every Star Wars movie since then, that's exactly how it starts, even the J.J. Abrams ones. Star Wars helped 20th Century Fox stay in business, make a profit.
Today, it is the second highest U.S. grossing movie of all time, adjusted for inflation. A Gone with the Wind is still number one. So it is second. It is the fourth highest worldwide. And it was hugely successful that year. And it, along with Jaws, changed the way Hollywood made movies.
I think the biggest change is that it really created the summer movie season. Before, school would end, May or June. Movies would be released anytime. when Jaws was released, that I think that's really what kicked it off. When Star Wars came out, that's just cemented the whole thing. From then on, people realized, oh, you know what? If you release a movie that kids are going to really want to go to see more than once, and this is before video, decades before streaming, some people go more than once a day, or they'd go at least several times a week to see the same movie over and over again. The studios realized that's a gold mine. If we release a movie that's going to get these kind of return viewers, then this is the ideal time to do it, when they don't have to be in school.
It did have a difficult time finding an opening, because it originally wasn't supposed to open for the summer, but then I think George Lucas got them to open it, I think, a little before the summer. But many of the theaters had already had their time blocked with other movies. What happened was the big movie was supposed to be The Other Side of Midnight. That was supposed to be that studio's really big movie that was going to make them a fortune. So they basically told theaters, you're going to have to play this if you want The Other Side of Midnight, because they didn't want to play it. They didn't really see the benefit of it. So I think even at the Chinese, it played for 2 weeks. They had to move it, refurbish a theater, because it was so successful. But they had to move it because they were contractually obligated to play, I think, Sorcerer.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I think Sorcerer came out that same weekend. And all I really know about that is that Roy Scheider's in it, and it's pretty much a remake of The Wages of Fear.
And some people love it and some people don't, but it was a big flop at the time. After the run was over, they moved Star Wars back to the Chinese, and it just ran forever and ran forever in other places too.
What I also remember is when it was originally released, it only was released in something like 30 or 35 theaters across the country. Part of the reason I know this is because I'm in San Francisco. The one theater that it was here, it was the Coronet. It was like one of the last remaining big movie palaces in the city. They had pictures after that was released of like the line really going almost around the block, and that's a big block too. And then after the box office returns came in and they realized, oh my God, we have a huge hit on our hands, that's when they kept adding more theaters to it. Yeah, so that was 77. I remember like summer of 1978, there was an ad in the paper celebrating 1 year of being in release. Right. And that's almost unfathomable today.
And then The Other Side of Midnight did eventually open to terrible reviews. Terrible movie, with only Susan Sarandon managing to escape unscathed, as Susan Sarandon often managed to do. But I think, though, that it also had a downside, because it and Jaws is probably the most important movie of that decade, changed the kind of movies that Hollywood made. They were going to break away from making the personal visionary films of directors like Coppola and other filmmakers at that time, and started to concentrate more and more on these big blockbusters. People started to complain about that. Then what happened is, because of that, you have the rise of the independent film movement with Spike Lee and Tarantino and the Coens, Kevin Smith, because the big Hollywood production companies, the studios, just weren't making those films anymore.
Yeah, that's very true. If you release a film and it makes a ton of money, you're going to want to try and repeat that process. You'll do whatever it takes. If you look at really the movies that came in the years after, there are more and more, as you said, big blockbuster type. And, you know, granted, there were also like the serious dramas and the smaller budget pictures, but those started to, you know, diminish a little bit. And there was more focus on the big blockbusters.
The studios sort of became almost self-devouring animals. They were so expensive to run, were so expensive to maintain, that in order to do so, in order to just make the next movie, they had to have an enormous profit. Because if a movie costs, let's say, $30 million to make, it has to make at the box office at least $45 million to break even. And if you make a series of movies during the year, and not all of them work, it has to make even more to be able to finance and cover the ones that don't work.
Right, right. And also something else that's really come into play, especially like probably the last 10, maybe even the last 20 years, is that now it's really about marketing.
Yes. The general rule is that the marketing will cost at least half as much as the film. So if a film costs $78 million, it's going to cost, what, $39 million to market at least. And you get into that spiral and you get into that way of making movies, and it's almost impossible to get out of it. You no longer control control the beast, the beast is now controlling you.
Yeah, the beast is never satisfied. But also, I remember seeing, I've seen it since on like YouTube, the original trailer. If you watch that, you would have no idea what the movie's about. I don't think they had any idea how to market it. You know, is it a kid's movie? I mean, originally it was going to be a G-rated movie. And Lucas was like, no, G is for Disney movies. So what could he do to make it PG? So like there's a shot of a severed arm with some blood on it. So that's what he did to get the ratings board up to PG. But if you watch the original trailer, it doesn't tell you the story because I think they had no idea how to sell this to the public. Part of the appeal of Star Wars is that, you know, I don't want to call it moral tones to it, but it's maybe about philosophy, you know, good versus evil, trying to fulfill your own destiny. And people have written thesis papers about the moral implications of the Jedi versus the Sith. I think that's part of the amazing thing about it. It's had such a widespread appeal on so many areas and so many aspects of how we look at it. Even every time you watch it, maybe you'll see something new about it.
Well, the basic philosophy of it, yes, is dates back to ancient Greece or before. It's basically a Menachian philosophy. There's equal forces of good and bad in the universe, and you have to make a choice as to which one you're going to be on. There's very little gray in the matter in good and evil in a Menachian way of looking at life. In the end, my favorite entry in the Star Wars franchise has always been Rogue One. And one of the reasons why is that I said it's basically about a group of people who are using amoral methods to prop up a religion or philosophy of absolutes. And I always thought that was an interesting dichotomy, that to have this absolute good and evil philosophy or religion, it takes people who are doing immoral and amoral things to prop it up.
I think that's a very interesting point. So I am curious, how do you feel about The Empire Strikes Back, which I think is, of all the movies, to me, that's the strongest, I guess, in terms of storytelling, because it's much darker than what people were expecting.
Of the three, that was always my favorite. And it is because it is darker. But you do notice that it wasn't as well received by the fans. And when it wasn't as well received, they went back to the formula of the first one for the third one. And in many ways got rid of a lot of that darkness.
Okay. You know, I could see that. I think, yeah, when it was initially released, it was not as well received. But I think over time, which, you know, granted, you know, the studios aren't interested in how things are received over time, it's become much more appreciated. And I think that's why a lot of people have really grown to love it and have such a high opinion of it.
I think that's very, very true. I do like Star Wars, and I like the trilogy. I put the trilogy together, not singly, on my list of top 100 films of all times. But at the risk of offending a lot of people out there, I don't think Star Wars is a particularly good movie. It's an exciting movie. It's a fun movie. It's an innovative movie. It's a very important movie in movie history. It's technologically brilliant, and it has a great plot. But I remember, even as I'm watching it the first time, as much as I'm enjoying it, my first thought was, you know you're in trouble when your androids have more personality and are much more three-dimensional than your humans. The three central characters, Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, and Princess Leia, are all very one-dimensional cardboard cutouts. There's no real depth or interesting personality to any of them. And the dialogue is awful. It's flat, banal, and bland. And the only people who get away with the dialogue are the androids, Alec Guinness, Peter Cushing, and James Earl Jones. And for me, Peter Cushing, Alec Guinness, and James Earl Jones could read the telephone book, and it would sound interesting. Two of my favorite memories of that period was one where Alec Guinness was interviewed, and he asked George Lucas, please do not put me in the sequel. I don't want to have to say those awful lines anymore. And my favorite quotes is Harrison Ford telling George Lucas, you know you can type this shit, but you can't say it.
Well, I think, yes, as you said, Star Wars is it's a good movie. Is it a great movie? I mean, that's debatable. It's definitely not a high art film. It's a movie for entertainment's sake. And right. It's telling a story in a unique way. As you said, all the ways that it was innovative and original, those still hold up. Does it compare to, you know, other very high quality films? No, because it's not supposed to. It's popcorn entertainment at its heart.
Right. And there's really no reason why it has to be any more than that. We don't necessarily watch space operas because we want to get out of it what we get out of Bergman or Antonioni. There's another aspect of it you might want to comment on, because I also felt this when I very first saw it. When I came out, I said, isn't it interesting that all the central characters, and especially all the good guys, are all white humanoids? Anybody else, the bad guys who weren't important to it, were all aliens of some sort. There really wasn't a good non-humanoid character. Not only that, they were all white. And this was a big criticism at the time. I don't think George Lucas did it on purpose. This was the time when you often didn't think in those terms. But then in the sequel, The Empire Strikes Back, they started to fix that. They had Billy Dee Williams as Lando Calrissian, and then they started also to have non-humanoid aliens as part of the Rebel Force. And ever since then, there's been no looking back. But what is interesting, when it came to the most recent of the trilogy, people got furious that the lead character was black.
It was very surprising. I guess people, especially the people who were around for the first trilogy, maybe they felt like, well, you know, this isn't my Star Wars. This is too different. You're just trying to be inclusive for inclusive. I can't say the word.
And my response to that is, well, of course they're being inclusive for inclusivity's sake. Why else do you be inclusive? That's life. But people didn't react to Lando Calrissian the same way they did to this. They all thought Lando Calrissian, Billy Dee Williams, that was a great bit of casting.
Well, you know, I didn't go online to read comments, because a lot of people just feel like it's, well, you know, this is my opinion and I'm right and you're wrong, and, you know, I don't need to see any of that. I didn't really have an issue with it. I thought it was nice, something different. You know, okay, so this character is black and the main character's female. Why is that a problem? I mean, you're of the opinion that my hero has to be the white guy. That gets boring after a while. You know, there's other people in the world besides, you know, just white men.
Have you ever seen Hardware Wars?
I've only seen snippets of it.
But it came out not long after it, and it was a satire of Star Wars, one of the many satires we get, Family Guy and Robot Chicken and The Simpsons. This came out pretty much at the time, not long after it. It's absolutely hysterical. The Death Star is a waffle iron. Egg beaters are one of the spaceships. And Princess Leia has bagels on the side of her head. It's basically coming attractions of Star Wars. And Tatooine is a basketball. I just recommend everybody to see it if they can. It has a line I will often use today. When sometimes when someone will ask if I saw a movie, sometimes I will quote Hardware Wars and say, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll kiss 10 bucks goodbye.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, because that also reminds me, because after the success of Star Wars, everybody was, oh, I want to make the next Star Wars. And so like even Roger Corman got into it, and he did his version, which was like Seven Samurai meets Star Wars, called Battle right. Beyond the Stars. And I have seen that. And you can tell it's a Roger Corman movie because it's yes. really, you know, it's low budget science fiction, but they got the most bang out of their bucks. It's a silly, fun movie.
It's a very, very clever movie. John Sayles was one of the ones who worked on the script. It is one of Roger Corman's best films. Star Wars got 10 Oscar nominations. It won art direction, scenic design, film editing, score, sound, and visual effects. It did not win original screenplay, director, picture, or supporting actor for Alec Guinness. Annie Hall was that year, and that won the screenplay, the director, and the picture, which was my favorite film of that year. Closing out, is there anything else you might want to add or say about Star Wars?
I think I said it in the beginning, you know, it definitely holds up. I think what's unique about it is that even though it spawned this $1 billion industry, it really comes down to this movie itself. If you see this movie, you don't need to see the rest of them. If you want to see the expanded story of everything in this world, you can watch the other two and watch the prequels and the J.J. Abrams ones. It's so self-contained. I think that's part of the uniqueness. It's a story unto itself. It doesn't need anything else. It hints at other things that they expand on in the other movies and I guess some of the TV shows and such. I think that's part of the enduring quality of it. Just by itself, it creates this world. For someone with a real active imagination who appreciates fun science fiction, it's a great way to just, you know, settle back and relax for 2 hours. I don't think it'll ever really go away. It's a great interpretation of the classic hero's journey. It's fun. It's a popcorn movie. It's not meant to be taken super seriously. It's just pure escapism fun.
So with that, let us move on to the next movie, which is Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress. And I will first begin with some information on it. It was released in 1958. The director is, of course, Akira Kurosawa. The music is by Masaru Suto. And it stars Toshiro Mifune, Misa Uehara, Minoru Chiaki, and Kamatari Fujiwara. Those last two played the two servants. The basic premise is long, long ago, in a metaphorical galaxy far, far away, in a time of civil war, a general and two bickering servants must transport a princess and her clan's gold to safety so she can rebuild her clan and save her people. Does that sound a bit familiar? When did you first see The Hidden Fortress?
I'm going to go with it was in film class in college. And of course, one of the points that the instructor made at the beginning was that this was one of the influences for George Lucas for Star Wars, because there's a lot of similarities, as you just said, with the storyline for Hidden Fortress and Star Wars. I guess the roguish, is he a samurai? Is he a ronin?
He's a general, actually.
Okay, he's a general. And the princess who needs help and two bumbling servants, they were really George Lucas's models for the characters that he would put into Star Wars. And that I remember watching the movie. Yeah, there were definitely a lot of similarities over the course of the story. And it's just interesting that that was one of his primary source materials.
And what did you think of the movie when you saw it?
I enjoyed it. At the time, we were really doing a big focus on Kurosawa movies, so we'd seen some of his other ones. I just love the way that he tells a story that, even with the subtitles, that it's such a visual presentation for him, that he gets so much out of what you see in the frame. He does a great job directing his actors. They act and emote, but they don't over-emote too much. I guess with Toshiro Mifune, sometimes he really pushes the envelope in terms of emoting, but I guess that's part of his appeal, is that he's such a visual actor in both his the way he moves and his expressions and the way his face reacts. I just really remember that. I do remember enjoying it and thinking I can see why this had such an influence on Lucas.
And do you think it still holds up?
That's the thing about Kurosawa's movies, is that even though a lot of them are set in medieval Japan, the storytelling and the presentation are so strong. It really puts you into that time period. And I think, do they hold up? Yeah, I would say so. His filmmaking, it's really transcending the time period. So even though it was, you said it was released in 58, that if you watch it, you're not going to think, oh, this was a movie from Japan in 1958. You're going to think, this is probably as historically accurate as they can make it. So, you know, I've seen a lot of period pieces for Japanese cinema. The detail and the way they tell the stories are just so amazing. You can tell they put so much care and effort into making them seem as authentic as possible. And I think Kurosawa does an amazing job when it comes to that.
Yes, I think it's certainly one of his greatest films. I saw it when it came out. Well, not when it came out. I was 4 years old in 1958, so let's not go there. I saw it when it came out, when it was re-released, I believe, in either the late 80s. I think it was the early 1990s. It was being distributed across the U.S. again. I went with a friend. One of my first reactions to it was when I saw the two servants. Almost immediately, I turned to my friend and said, boy, those two remind me of R2-D2 and C-3PO. And I didn't know the connection at the time. It just seemed very, very obvious that there was something going on here. And then later on, I did find out that it was a huge influence on the making of Star Wars. And I guess one of the things that helped him key in on Star Wars and how to write it was that, in many ways, The Hidden Fortress is seen from the viewpoint of the two servants. And that makes up a bulk of the story in many ways. Toshiro Mifune and the princess are supporting characters, and the two servants are actually the central characters. And that's what he did with Star Wars, is by focusing on the android and seeing the movie a great deal from their perspective.
I think that's another thing that Kurosawa really does well, was that even though you might have a character who is not the main character, just really supporting or even maybe in one or a couple of scenes, he gives them things to do or things to say that still make a difference. They make an impact on the scene, if not the whole story. It makes them that much more memorable. So even though they might not have as much screen time as the main characters, they're still an integral part of the story, and that you will remember them even after it's been a while since you've seen the movie. Like, oh yeah, there's that one character who's in like three scenes, but you still remember it because that's the kind of attention he would put. It's not just all about the main characters and everyone else is just background. Everybody has a role to play in his stories.
Right. It was his first widescreen movie, and it certainly does look beautiful on the screen. After that, all of his films were then widescreen. It was the fourth highest grossing release in Japan. It was the highest grossing film for that particular studio that year. And it was the most successful Kurosawa film until Yojimbo in 1961. But it actually didn't do very well in the U.S., and it actually didn't get very good reviews. One of the reasons is, like Star Wars, it's really not much more than just an adventure film. It's not like The Seven Samurai or Rashomon or things later on like Yojimbo or Kagamusha or Ran, which try to do a lot more than just provide an adventure story. They're trying to be very insightful into life and the universe. But this is just pretty much a really, really straightforward, entertaining adventure film. I think the critics weren't ready for that in the U.S.
Do you think people were just expecting a certain type of film from him, and then when this came, and then it was not what they were expecting, and it was maybe, as you said, a little lighter than what he had done before? Do you think they kind of like, it's not as good? Because they were expecting something a little deeper, and that people kind of almost looked down their noses at it.
I think that's sort of a lot of the approach that the critics had. It also didn't do as well at the box office. I'm sure the critics had something to do with that because it was a foreign film, and foreign films often depend very much on critical response to get people to go see it. But with its re-release in the 1990s, never since then, it has grown very much in esteem with U.S. critics. They think it's a much, much better film than the critics thought when it was first released. And it is a fun film.
It's just not a deep film.
It's not a particularly deep film. It's interesting that there's no reason why we should support the princess and Toshiro Mifune, the general.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who they are. As far as we know, they could be fascist, and that's why their feudal lands were being run over by their enemies. In Star Wars, instantly, whose side to be on once Darth Vader, once he blows up a planet.
Well, it also makes me realize that because, some of Kurosawa's real standouts are based on other stories. Because Throne of Blood, isn't that based on Macbeth?
That's Macbeth.
Ron, I know, is King Lear.
The Bad Sleep Well is Hamlet, which is a modern day story. It's not a samurai story. What do you think of, of Eric Kurosawa as a whole?
I really enjoy it. I'm trying to think. The first one I saw was The Seven Samurai. It might have been in high school because I had a film appreciation class. That's where I was really introduced to a lot of classic films, and I think that was one of them. I think what the instructor, he would take like a classic movie and then kind of show, you would call it an alternate take on it. So part of the reason I took the class is that not only did I love film, I had heard that a year or two before he had shown, the 1931 Frankenstein. And then as the follow-up, he showed Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein, just to kind of as a nice contrast. But also, if you do watch the two of them together, there's so many things that Mel Brooks used from the original, not just the set, but also a lot of the character traits and the tropes of the genre. And I just thought that sounded like a lot of fun. So we watched The Seven Samurai, but then we watched The Magnificent Seven. I have the DVD of The Magnificent Seven, and there's a mini documentary. Yul Brynner saw Seven Samurai, and he's like, I've got to bring this to America. They were trying to what's the equivalent? It's cowboys. I think Seven Samurai is a much deeper film compared to Magnificent Seven. I love them both. Both are wonderful stories. Same story, just told in two different ways and for two different genres. Getting back to Kurosawa, again, I just love the way he tells the story, not just about the characters, but how it just seems almost like it's freezing a moment in time, that it just feels so authentic, the way the characters act and what they say and how the sets look. It just really feels like a real window into that time period of whatever in Japan's history that it's taking place.
Right. Kurosawa, it'd be hard to argue, is one of the giants in film history. Along with Ozu, he's probably the two greatest directors that have come out of Japan. I love so many of his films, and he did a lot of different kinds of film. I think people tend to more remember his samurai films because of Seven Samurai and Rashomon and Yojimbo, and then finally Ran and Kagemusha. But he also did some wonderful dramas like Ikiru about a dying man and High and Low, which has to be the greatest kidnapping movie ever.
I did see that one. I knew it sounded familiar then when you said about the kidnapping. I had seen that one. The other one you mentioned, is that the one about the man who realizes he's dying and his one objective is to create a children's park or a children's playground?
Right.
Okay, yes, I did see that one too.
The bureaucracy at the time, as many people in the U.S. could probably identify with, just makes it almost impossible to ever get something like that done. But it seemed to be even worse in Japan.
Yeah, and that's what it was, because I remember reading the description of them and I thought, oh, this sounds really interesting. And also, you know, there were, you know, rave reviews about it. This is probably like in the early days of Netflix. I was just getting discs at a time. And then when it said directed by Kurosawa, I was like, I had no idea. I guess I had just associated him with strictly historical films, samurai films from Japanese history, that it never even occurred to me like, oh yeah, I guess he can make whatever kind of movie he wants. If he wants to make something that set in the modern day, in this case, you know, like 1963, yeah, he can do that. And it'll still be just as effective. I guess to me, his samurai movies, they made more of an impact. I guess I'm always fascinated and amazed when a historical piece is done well and so effectively that it just feels so authentic that it really sticks with me.
Those are the ones that people think of first. Those are the ones that made him internationally famous, Rashomon and the Seven Samurai. Though I would venture to guess that the majority of his films are not samurai films. They're of various different kind of genres, even beginning back when he started making films during the war.
Actually, I was in this discussion, actually, you might have even been part of this, it was online, that someone said, are there directors that, you know, apart from film buffs and film and aficionados that are, for the most part, almost forgotten today? Because the reason I was thinking about this, because last weekend I watched this movie called Ball of Fire from 1941,
right.
Barbara Stanwyck and Gary Cooper. It's Howard Hawks directed it. And then was even more amazing during the credits, Billy Wilder was one of the co-writers on it, which, and as I said to my friends, like, oh yeah, you can tell because a lot of the dialogue and the scenarios in the story, they're very Billy Wilder-esque. It made me think, if you went to your average film goer today, because it's 2020, and this is, you know, like 60, 70, 80 years ago, how many people are going to know who Howard Hawks was? If you say, oh, he was a director. Well, what did he direct? You'd have to like go to his most popular, well-known films. Taking you back to Kurosawa, you know, if you say Kurosawa to me, I'm automatically going to think Seven Samurai, Ran, and Kagemusha, and Rashomon. These are what he's known for. I think it's almost a dying art for that kind of director, because it's not just a job. You can see the passion, their love of the material on the screen. They really put so much effort into doing as ideal a story and telling it the way they want to. I think there's maybe a handful now who would still qualify for that sort of thing. It just seems a lot more prevalent in decades past.
I sort of have a couple of responses to that. My big problem isn't that young film goers don't know them, because they're young, and even in the 1950s and 60s, you'd ask a lot of people who these filmmakers are, and a lot of the people who just went to the movies might not know even then. But filmmakers knew. Lucas, Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, and people like that, they all knew. They studied these people, they grew up on these people, they loved these films. The issue I have today is that young filmmakers, at least among the ones I know, they don't really know who these people are. And not only do they not know, they don't care, and they don't seem to know why they should care. At the same time, you know, times change and philosophies change. Ingmar Bergman is probably the most important and influential filmmaker of the 50s, 60s, 70s. But existentialism and his themes and his approach, well, they're passé now. The only place you find existentialism now is in some European films and on TV. But among the new filmmakers that are coming, I mean, even the really new ones, the ones that aren't studio filmmakers, they don't know or care about existentialism because it's a philosophy that's of no use anymore. It's had its time and it doesn't really have enough to say. I actually even just kind of realized this in the last year that that's one of the reasons why it's not as influential anymore, is because it's a dead-end philosophy to some degree. It can only take you so far. Filmmakers, they don't really know these old filmmakers and they don't really care. That's the impression I get. And I could be proved wrong, but that's the impression I get.
Well, I think part of it is all that, as you said, times have changed. And right now, granted, it's always been a business. Now, I think it's easier for people to get their content out there. So a filmmaker, you either have to make a huge splash with something, you know, totally original and innovative, or you've released your movie and it's popular for 15 minutes. And then, you know, people move on to the next thing. It's just different. I didn't even know if you could try to release a Bergman-esque film now, because really it's been like, well, the first question people are going to want to know is, you know, what's it about? You know, how did it do with the box office? Those are really the big questions. You know, and it doesn't really sound like it's not my cup of tea. I'll pass.
I'm not sure there's necessarily anything exactly wrong with that, because every generation has to find their own themes and their own ideas and the things they want to pursue. So I don't really have a huge problem with someone like Bergman being replaced, because that's inevitable. It happens in all art forms. And I think the excitement is seeing what comes new. And I think for a while we were lost in the U.S. as to what was coming next and what was going to be the next generation, because the previous generation, which is Tarantino and the Coens and Kevin Smith, Spike Lee and those filmmakers, well, they're now becoming the previous generation. The new generation now is coming along, and I think they have found their theme and their idea, for better and for worse. And I think it's diversity meets genre. Genre is the big thing. You want to make something in some sort of genres. It doesn't matter what it is, horror, crime, sci-fi, rom-com, and you want to bring diversity to it. You know, you have rom-coms like The Big Sick, which involves someone, the central character is non-white. You had the movie with Awkwafina, which is a family drama about a grandmother dying. Get Out, which is horror with a black central character. You have rom-coms that are gay-led, like Love, Simon. I think that's great. I think that's the way things are going now. And I actually predict that 2019, we may look back on as being perhaps the most important year in recent film history, because that is the year where a huge number of the new emerging filmmakers made films. And they either got a lot of attention, or they made money, or they got Oscar nominations. And I think we're on the verge of a new wave.
Yeah, and I think what's even more interesting about that is that, taking it even back to Star Wars, that a lot of the studios, they're almost creating self-defeating cycles that, you know, okay, we released this big money-making movie. Well, now we need to make even more money to get the next one and to market it. So they keep having to rely on a shrinking pool of what's going to make a lot of money for us. By doing that, they're shooting themselves in the foot. They're denying themselves the opportunity to release films that are much smaller budgets, but can also be just as popular. But they think, you know, well, we have to go for the big tentpole kind of movies because that's where the money is, with more filmmakers who are kind of like almost taking it upon themselves. And also now you don't automatically need the studio system to release a movie. You can release it online. You can have it done through streaming, because there are so many more venues to do it in.
Now, both are very important. I often say that you can't have an art form without a huge influx of cash. So you need these movies that the studios are making, because they bring in a huge amount of cash. But if you also don't have uniqueness and originality, people trying something new, then an art form implodes and it just sort of deteriorates.
Yeah, that's what I've seen. A lot of people are like, how many more superhero movies can they keep making? People are just going to get tired of them. I will say I love the superhero movies, but I don't want just superhero movies. I want a wide variety of films. As much as I love the Marvel movies, there's so much more than that that's available. You know, I want those kind of movies, but I also want everything else.
Right. With that, let's start drawing it to a close. One of the things I asked was you to choose a film or two in the same vein as your choice, Star Wars, that you would recommend for people to watch.
Okay, well, I'm not going to keep it that kind of science fiction, because I remember when you originally asked me to appear, I gave you two options. My second movie was Back to the Future. That is one of my absolute favorite films. It's a science fiction comedy. That is also another self-contained story. But I think part of the reason I like it so much, I think the screenplay is like right up there with Chinatown for being absolutely bulletproof. It had such an influence on me. There's so many great setups and payoffs. There's absolutely no fat. There's nothing that doesn't have to be in there. Everything plays a role. Everything that's set up in the first 20 to 25 minutes plays out somehow over the next hour and a half. It's just a fun movie. We have seen it many, many times, and it never gets old.
Well, you might be pleased to know then that I think in 2 weeks right now, the plan is someone has chosen Back to the Future.
Aha.
We are pairing it with the French film by Christopher Chris Barker, La Jetée, which is also a time travel movie.
That was the inspiration for 12 Monkeys, I want to say.
Right. For me, I will not be too original, but I will choose two samurai films. Of course, The Seven Samurai by Akira Kurosawa, which is about a group of unemployed samurai that band together to help protect a village from some bandits. Basically for no more pay than a handful of rice. The other one is Harry Carey by Masaki Kubagashi. It is about a time when samurai are pretty much out of style. They have a hard time finding employment. They can't find work. They can't make money. So what some of them do is they go from clan to clan, tell them that if I do not get food or if I do not get some sort of support, I'm going to kill myself. And usually this is all for show. What usually happens is the leader of the clan gives them something and they go away. But one clan decides that they're tired of it. They say, fine, kill yourself. We will watch you do it. And that starts a chain of events. The last thing that we will cover is if you could let us know what we should be looking for, what's happening with you.
Okay. Let's see. The shameless self-promotion begins. I run the screenwriting blog called Maximum Z. It is at MaximumZ.blog. It is me talking about my screenwriting journey and also trying to give out some pieces of advice. And also I do a ton of interviews with script consultants, such as one Howard Kasner, and also filmmakers.
I remember that.
Okay. I'm glad. I've talked to some filmmakers and also people who are writers in other mediums. I've talked to a couple of comic book writers and a few people working in TV and just finding about their insights about a little bit about them and, you know, how they feel about various aspects of writing, especially for screenwriting. I also am a co-host on the Creative Writing Life podcast. You can find that pretty much anywhere most podcasts are found, iTunes and Stitcher, that sort of thing. And I am on Twitter at @Maximum_Z. I love to follow people and I love to interact with other creative types, especially screenwriters and filmmakers.
Great. Yes, I should make an announcement that I too am on iTunes. For me, I'll go through my usual litany. I am a script consultant. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I talk about issues pertaining to screenwriting and movies in general. I have published a few books on Amazon, two books of short stories, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion, which are fantasy, sci-fi, horror short stories. I have published the second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader. I do have a Facebook page, Howard Kasner, Script Consultant. I've published a book of my plays, and I'm an amateur photographer, and you can find that on Instagram. When it comes to pop art, our most recent episode was with Adam Ferenz, and we did two movies about filmmaking, Singing in the Rain and Irma Vep. Our next episode will be with Riley of Riley on Film. He chose The Omen, and to stick with the theme of evil kids, I chose the 1960 version of Village of the Damned. So with that, I want to thank you again for being on the show. I very much appreciate you joining me.
Well, thank you very much. It was great to be here.
And thank you, everybody, for listening.